Coming up on Nurse Talk, don't take your eye off the Republican podium. They're working right now to make deep cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security to pay for tax breaks for the wealthy.
And something light for our listeners who have toddlers and newborns, our resident baby whisperer, RN Marcia Pod, shares secrets from a baby nurse, and you won't want to miss what she has to say.
And Kaiser Health News shares the bill of the month. A transgender woman's quest for surgery gets caught in political crosswinds.
All this and more today on Nurse Talk.
Welcome to Nurse Talk. I'm Casey Hobbs, along with my wonderful co-host, Shane Mason, who wasn't eaten by bears. And we are two of the thousands of nurses on duty today.
And Casey, we'd like to take a moment to thank all of our listeners on Progressive Voices TuneIn, the Tom Hartman Program, WFTE Radio in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and all of our broadcast platforms.
Thank you. Shane, you just got back from Alaska. How was it?
It's beautiful up there. It's beautiful and it's strange. There's 22 hours of daylight every day. So
wow.
That's very weird. It's very easy to find yourself it's like, oh, it's 1:30 in the morning and I'm still like walking around town or whatever.
Wow. And did you get close to Wasilla?
Fortunately, I did not. I just want to say no one up there talks like Sarah Palin. That whole thing is an act.
That is an act. Isn't that ridiculous? So there isn't that Alaskan accent.
I thought there was
an accent.
No.
Yeah.
No, there's not. But it's extremely beautiful up there. Everywhere you look is just gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous. But yeah, it's an odd
place.
Did
you almost get eaten by bears?
I got really close to
wild bears. Right next to you, which is very scary to me.
Yep.
Obviously, they're so... I guess he had food in his mouth, so forget it.
Yeah,
he didn't care about you.
It's good to know that a salmon smells more like salmon than I do, because that's the only thing that kept me safe, I think.
Well, thank God I wasn't there. Shane, we have a great show today. With all the issues our country is dealing with, we thought it would be nice to slip in a light, informative conversation with our resident baby whisperer, RN Marcia Pod.
And later on, Healthcare in America with Donna Smith, we look at the politics of healthcare and gender, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid proposed cuts are on the table. And surprise, surprise, thanks to the Koch brothers, we have more proof that single payer saves money. Oh, and by the way, those findings were unintentional, so you've got to like that irony.
Indeed. Now here's our special interview with RN and author of Secrets of a Baby Nurse, Marcia Pod.
Okay, so we know it's not your baby crying, and I certainly hope it's not mine, but it's a sign that the baby whisperer, RN Marcia Pod, is in the building. Marcia is also the author of one of the best-selling baby books in the country, Secrets of a Baby Nurse, and our special in-studio guest today. So welcome.
Thank you. Always nice to have you with us.
Great, Marcia.
Great to be back.
And congratulations for your second nomination of the Best Baby Sleep Consultant in Marin County. And if you win this, will this be your second win?
Yes, it
Very
will.
Very nice.
So,
it will.
So is there a baby sleep consultant around that you need me to go intimidate or meet
yeah,
in the do, parking
does
lot
he need
with
to do
a baseball bat?
Does he need to do an I, Tanya on her?
Yeah, totally.
You know, actually, I'm happy to share it with others. So if somebody else gets nominated and wins, that's cool too because, you know.
See,
that's not how you get to the top, Marcia.
That's what makes you such a good baby nurse. And that's why she could never work in the White House.
You're right.
So, Marcia, this week in the news, there were several reports of tragic infant deaths. Let's listen to this clip.
A local baby's death is under investigation, and the medical examiner's office tells us it may have been caused by co-sleeping.
Your baby won't go to sleep, you're tired, mom needs some rest, and so they end up putting baby in bed with them.
Health officials say that if you sleep in the same bed with your baby, that you shouldn't do it. And if you are still doing it, you should stop immediately.
So that was a clip from Jacksonville, Florida News 4. An estimated 3,500 infants die each year from deaths related to sleep.
Wow.
Together, these are called sudden unexpected infant deaths, which include both sudden infant death syndrome and deaths from suffocation, asphyxiation, strangulation, and other preventable deaths.
So, Marcia, can you shed some light on the differences here between co-sleeping and bed sharing?
Well, a lot of people think of co-sleeping as actually being in the bed together, but it's really defined as sharing the same bedroom. So if your baby's in a bassinet right next to your bed, that's technically co-sleeping. A better word is bed sharing. So bed sharing is more specific to the fact that a parent and the baby share the same bed. Sometimes it's just the mom and the baby. Sometimes it's the mom, the dad, and the baby. And sometimes it's another older child. So the more people, the more risk, and the more blankets and covers and pillows, the more risk.
Yeah, just so easy to roll over in your sleep on the baby.
Right.
And then the baby can't even make a sound.
You know, and unfortunately, everybody's heard about the increase of use of opioids and other narcotics. So I just like to say that some of these statistics in death is related to drug use as well as bed sharing. So co-sleeping, technically sharing the same bedroom, is recommended for at least the first 6 to 12 months. A new study came out recently showing how 4-month-old babies, when moved to a separate room, actually got better sleep and more sleep, and so did the mom, and there was less postpartum depression. So there's some confusion now about when the baby should be out of the room and how long they should be in the room. But I always say to parents, you know, it's your choice, what feels right to you. If you can't sleep with your baby in the bedroom, then you should move your baby farther away, out in the hall or into a separate space, so that you can sleep, because that's, you know, really important to recovery and sanity.
So what are some of the reasons besides just tiredness that people may co-sleep or bed share?
Well, sick children. That's a real common one. If your baby develops a cough or a cold, parents think if having them close to them, it's going to make a difference. Mattresses are a real important part of this, because so many people are getting the soft memory foam type of mattresses, and that's not a firm surface. That's not acceptable by the Safe Sleep Organization as a safe place to put the baby. Now, there's other things like the Dock-a-Tot, which is a circular little bed that was invented in Sweden, and that's kind of the new rage right now. And then that's so easy to put your baby in this little compartment and then stick that compartment on top of your bed or in your bed. And so I see a lot of those being used, and that makes me really nervous, because I can just visualize a very young baby trying to roll over and getting stuck, and their face is in that soft fabric that is on the sides. So the recommendation is no sleep positioners of any kind. I just looked at the website for the Dock-a-Tot. They don't promote it as a sleeping place, but a parking place. And so parents don't see it that way. They believe that that's where they should be putting their babies to go to sleep. And it's convenient and it's cozy. And so they have been using that. And it's a pricey little thing. And a lot of people get it for gifts. And then all of a sudden, the baby's in the bed. Unfortunately, babies are dying every day from being in bed with parents, and other unsafe practices like putting your baby down and surrounding your baby with pillows, thinking they're not going to fall off the bed that way. So there's a lot of factors involved in it. One of the saddest things that I have come across, and by the way, a third of the people that I go into their homes, I see unsafe sleep practices. I tell people, take the comforters off the side. Remove the pillows from the crib mattress. You know, take this bumper pad away and make just the mattress and the crib, tight-fitting mattress. I'm amazed how many parents say, I'm okay with that. That doesn't bother me. It's not going to happen to my child.
Yeah.
And it's important to have a soft, safe place for my child. Just recently, I was just talking on the phone during a consultation, and somebody shared that their baby slept on a duvet in a crib. A 9-month-old. And I said, oh, but that baby can grab the corner of the duvet and roll up and turn into a burrito and suffocate. And I said, please take it out. It's very unsafe. But it's not so soft and cozy, the mother says. And I said, well, have you tried it without? No. I said, would you try it without? And she called me because the baby was continually waking up at night. And 3 days later, the baby's been sleeping through the night. Because she took the duvet. Because now the baby could roll over and sleep on the tummy, which is probably what he was trying to do, but couldn't breathe. Was waking up. So those are just reminders that there's reasons why we have safe sleep standards.
And what's so important about that is because people are thinking about themselves, how you want a warm, cozy bed with lots of blankets and stuff, but that's for an adult who's fully functional or a child who's fully functional, not for a baby. So people don't understand the baby doesn't have quite the mobility. And so you do want less. You just want that tight mattress, you know, with
and
not
strength.
A lot of stuff.
A lot of it is about strength. The peak of SIDS usually happens around 4 months. And that's just the time when a baby's you know, starting to move more, maybe not able to get totally over one or the other direction, and get stuck. And that's a real common age. So I'm really promoting strength building in infants from birth, you know, lots of tummy time, practicing movement skills, because the brain then learns it, the muscles get stronger, and then they're safer in their sleeping.
What do you recommend parents do to educate themselves about the risks?
Well, you can go online. There's lots of information on safe sleeping standards. There's organizations that actually, you know, have written lists of all of the details. And some of the things that I like to just mention are that having the right temperature in the room, we're all supposed to sleep in a cooler room than a warmer room. Mm-hmm. So for infants, I recommend 65 to 70. In Europe, they recommend less than that.
Wow.
60 to 65 is a common temperature there.
Interesting.
But we know that we sleep better in a cooler room. We mm-hmm. breathe better in a cooler room. So putting more layers on you, is, you know, or your baby, is the important factor in sleeping in a cooler room. And then always on the baby's back. But if the baby is strong enough and learns how to roll over either direction, it's okay. You can let them be. You don't have to correct that. They will get stronger. And again, it's teaching your baby both ways how to roll. And making sure that there's nothing loose around the baby at all, even if you think it's out of the way of the baby, babies can move and grab things. So make sure there's nothing nearby hanging over the edge or on a table nearby that the baby can grab and pull into the crib.
So now a lot of people know about SIDS, and I know this isn't the same as that. So talk about the differences of those two. And also the emphasis you were saying about teaching your baby from birth, getting exercises to be able to have it turn over and do that.
Yeah, what I find is interesting, the longer I have been a nurse, the more I observe that when I'm working with a mom who has been exercising during her pregnancy, she has a stronger baby. I can tell in the first few days when I pick up a newborn if this mom has been a couch potato or she has been in the gym or a runner.
Interesting.
Because she has a strong baby.
I don't know. I just find that weird.
But that makes sense, because
makes
if
sense,
you're getting strong, then the baby is also.
Right.
That's training its little brain. Interesting.
Yeah. When people move and you're floating a baby inside of you, that baby is counteracting that movement.
Wow. So it's already
and building
getting stronger.
Muscles.
Smart.
Yes.
Smart, smart.
Yes. They come out advanced. So we know that movement advances the brain. And so, you know, even if it's you moving them, they're getting, you know, their brain advanced and they're getting stronger physical skills.
And
so
certainly
it's only
with,
going for good to yes. do all that.
And certainly with autism, you see that movement is key
yeah.
in helping them function.
In
so you
everything.
Can see movement is
yeah.
big. Well, the way they say the yeah. sitting is the new smoking.
Well, I always think at the opposite end of the spectrum, when you're aging, you're you know, we now know that if you build even one muscle cell, you're preserving your brain.
That's
so the
great.
More you sit still as you get older, the more your brain deteriorates. And when you're at the beginning of life, the more you move, the more your brain advances. So we know that people that move are healthier.
Well,
and it starts in the womb.
And it's so important, because last week we talked to a man with Alzheimer's who is 9 years in and is still able to have a conversation with us. And he reports the most important thing for him is exercise. It's movement. It's
right.
the constant movement right. to keep your brain healthy.
With many diseases, that's true. I know that's
very
true with
so.
Parkinson's, too.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's so people don't think that they should like be exercising their baby on the floor, but it does matter. It
yes.
really does matter to build strength. And that, to me, is one of the best things parents can do to make their babies safer and less likely to die of SIDS. But SIDS is a potluck term for all infant deaths that can't be immediately explained. So even suffocation is in that statistic. And that's what the saddest death is, because you really can prevent that. So true SIDS, you can't really prevent. I do believe it has something to do with the development of the brain and certain communications that aren't there that, you know, relate to breathing. So, you know, there's nothing we can really do to prevent a true SIDS definition
Right, but that's a small portion of the overall problems that can be prevented, indeed.
Anything else you'd like to share with our listeners about baby sleep safety before you go, Marcia?
There's a variety of cultures that believe they need to keep their babies' heads covered from birth. And I have personally found a few babies hidden under the covers, even with supervision, that when I went to go examine them, they were already pale or blue because of the lack of oxygen. So don't put blankets, don't put sheets, don't put any of those things over your baby's head. Keep enough space around your baby's head so there's enough airflow. And using a little fan or an air filter in the baby's room is also wonderful.
I just think that you got to pass a test or something before you have a kid. Like,
well, I wish we would have a little test because
you got to take the test. And,
well, it's so true because so many people come home with their baby, and you know, my brother was one of those who was just like, I cannot believe they just gave me that baby and let me take it home because I don't know anything.
All right, so we're talking with RN and baby nurse Marcia Pod. Marcia's the author of the best-selling book Secrets of a Baby Nurse. You can learn more about her practice at gotosleepbaby.com. And up next, another outrageous medical bill, and this one gets political. And thanks to the Koch brothers, a study reveals Medicare for All would save money.
You're listening to Nurse Talk Radio.
You're listening to Nurse Talk, where laughter's the best medicine.
You know those gowns they give you in the hospital that are open in the back? Reminds me of our healthcare system. No matter how much you pay for insurance, it just doesn't cover your ass. What we need is California OneCare. Full coverage, all the time, for everybody, for everything. So if you feel that cool breeze coming from the south, join the campaign for California OneCare. Get involved and get covered.
California OneCare. Full care for all, for less.
We are nurses, so we cannot diagnose, prescribe, or treat. But listen to us anyway, because we like to talk.
Welcome back to Nurse Talk. I'm Casey Hobbs, along with Shane Mason, and we are two of the thousands of nurses on duty today.
Well, and that music can mean only one thing, that we've ruined another Saturday for Donna Smith.
No, Shane, that music means longtime healthcare activist and executive director of Progressive Democrats of America, Donna Smith, is joyfully sharing her Saturday with us and has important issues to share with our listeners.
All right, Donna, welcome. Great to have you with us, and let's step right into the news.
Thank you so much, Shane. I hear you're just back from Alaska, eh?
Yeah, I'm just back from Alaska. It's weird up there.
Yeah,
It's not the United States, but it is the United States, which is kind of strange, you know?
Yeah, it is so different.
I'll bet it's amazing. My sister lives there, but I've never visited her there, that's for sure.
Oh, you should go. Yeah, it's beautiful.
It is gorgeous, but there's a little too much wildlife for my taste.
yeah. Well, before the permafrost all melts, the climate change, it'd be good to go. Yeah.
Yes, indeed.
So last week, the far-right Mercatus study related to the Koch brothers were released. And this is interesting. The study was done to undermine the growing movement for Medicare for All, but instead illustrated why Medicare for All is the only real solution for an escalating healthcare crisis. So can you tell us a little bit about why the study was done and how this good news ended up being released after all?
Sure. The study was commissioned in part by the Koch brothers because they were wanting to have a lot of great ammo to fight against this terrible moving towards this single-payer stuff. And when it was released, of course, great fanfare, and Paul Ryan, Speaker of the House, thought that he would use that study and say, see, it's going to cost $26 trillion to make Medicare for All happen in this country. Well, it seems Paul should have turned the page a couple, two or three down the road to see that when you actually did the comparison, that it actually, yes, the government would end up spending trillions of dollars. We already spend more trillions of dollars doing what we're doing now. So the study actually reinforced the fact that we would save money if we went to Medicare for All. So what's always brilliant about this is when you can get opposition research that reinforces what you've been saying all along. And I thought Bernie was brilliant, Bernie Sanders, in the way that he put forward a thank you to the Koch brothers. And I never thought I'd see Bernie Sanders thank the Koch brothers, but gay Bernie.
Fantastic. So, Donna, The Hill had an article this week, Tax Breaks for Wealthy Paid For with Deep Cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security.
Yep.
So talk about this. This is very scary.
Yeah, this is more of the same, only getting more concerning as we go forward. You know, we had this gigantic Trump tax cut for the wealthy not very long ago that he keeps celebrating that he's done. Well, the piper's got to be paid at some point, and we elevated the deficit in this country by about $2 trillion just by making sure the wealthy would get their taxes cut. Well, their plan at this point is to take back those funds from the social safety net, from Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, the food stamps, the things that people really have to rely on when times are difficult for them, and the things that we've all paid into as earned benefits for Medicare and Social Security. So we understand part of the plan is to do the ever-popular move by the conservative folks is to move towards a voucherized Medicare program where you essentially would get a voucher for part of premiums and the remainder you would have to pay yourself. Well, that's not the way the Medicare program has worked in the past. And I don't think most of us want it to work that way going forward. So let's not cut the taxes for the wealthy any more than we already have. And let's make sure we protect the social safety net and let them find the money somewhere else.
Republicans have wanted to get rid of Medicare since it started. And is it simply just because it's Democratic legislation, or what's the underlying?
Good question, Shane. I think most of it relates to the ideology, this notion of an entitlement program, you know, that it's something evil, that people want something for nothing, that those lazy people want to get their benefits. And they're always trying to sell Medicare as being basically a welfare program. And for many of us who either ourselves or know somebody in our family or in our neighborhood who've had to rely on the traditional welfare benefits, I don't have any problem with people needing and getting welfare. I think it's good. But over time, the conservatives and the Republicans have always shaded Medicare in that same light, saying that they believe that welfare, people should have to work. You know, by God, I got mine. I pulled myself up by the bootstraps, and everybody should have to do that. Even the insurance companies, if the Republicans would even think about it, when Medicare was first formed, it in part was formed because the insurance companies did not want to have the elderly and people who had severe health problems in their insurance pools. They wanted those folks insured by anybody else but them. I was reading yet another article this week about how much of the federal budget, how much of our entitlement spending goes to Walmart employees.
Yes.
And here we have six members of the Walmart family who I'm betting have this same ideology.
Oh, yeah.
That
correct.
Believe that, oh my gosh, we've worked so hard for ours. Seriously?
Yeah.
I would like to know if any of those folks have ever really worked very hard. And that's also beside the point for me. When somebody needs help, when they're sick or they're hurt, I don't really care to measure whether or not they work as hard as I do or as hard as the neighbor does. We just need to help and help one another, period.
And all of those tax breaks also went to stock buybacks. Like all that money
yes.
is just, it's not going to the employees, it's
correct.
Going to the shareholders.
Which
of
is
going
to create another disaster in the banking industry, yet
of
again.
Course.
And we'll have to bail them out of that too.
Yes, and it'll be 5 or 6 years down the road when, you know, our kids and our grandkids. I cannot imagine, if you think about right at the moment, how history will reflect on this period
oh,
that we're
yeah,
in
yeah,
right
yeah.
at the moment, that's
yes.
why we're all fighting,
yes.
is because most of us don't want to leave a mess to our children and our grandchildren and future generations. Most of us want to leave the conditions better than what we found them. But boy, it's a fight right at the moment to try and do that.
It's definitely a fight.
We want to move on to some Kaiser Health news. So our medical bill of the month here, this time it's political and personal. This happened to Ren Vettens. Can you tell us a little bit about Wren first?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we know that Trump and Mike Pence and the, you know, the ultra-conservative movement is certainly targeting a lot of our LGBTQ community and trans community and so forth. And a lovely young woman trying to complete the process of getting surgical intervention for a transition in gender, and was moving along the process, had been gone through the process of being approved, all the psychological counseling components, and approved for hormone therapy, had even done some of the surgical preparation work for her surgery, and then have all the changes take place in the Trump administration, and what's going to be paid for and what isn't going to be paid for in the Obamacare regulations that said that you could not discriminate against trans people or gender gender-based issues was removed. And so right in the middle of this process, and this is just one young woman, could be any number of people and is any number of people around the country, now are stopped in the process. Either you'll have to come up with the cash to complete your surgery, or perhaps you're not going to be able to get it done. What a horrific thing to do to people. Imagine if it were cancer. Imagine if it were any of our other medical treatments or care that we went for and we told somebody, I'm sorry, we choose to not think that's a good idea anymore, so we're not going to cover that.
Well, sadly, that's already happened, of course. People are being denied services every day because of the insurance they have.
This is just hideous, though. I mean, this is so bad. You know, Jeff Sessions last week, they announced that he's starting this commission on religious freedom.
They're so good with the naming. They're always so good.
Oh, my goodness. Now, that's just code for taking an attack at everything. That, you know, you remember how they talked about we didn't want to make employees pay for birth control if they had a religious objection to that. That was the whole Hobby Lobby case with the Affordable Care Act and so forth. Well, they're taking on other issues just exactly the same way, whether it's abortion, whether it's birth control, whether it's LGBTQ issues, no matter what it is, that's the way they're going to take it on. Is you're harming my religious freedom if I have to pay for something that I object to in my religion. That is ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. People are getting fatigued with a constant nonstop barrage of nonsense that this president and his administration is pulling. But we have to remember, we have to stay vigilant and we have to stay compassionate. Now more than ever, we need to love and support our neighbors and our friends.
I couldn't agree more. You have no idea how many people are worried, how many people are suffering, how many people are doing so quietly because they're afraid to really step up and say too much right now. Not everybody can get out in the street and protest, and not everybody can fight back. And we have to be kind to one another and find ways to lift one another and say that we're not, you know, yes, we're not going to stand for this, but the best way to fight back is to stand with your neighbor and friends when they're under siege.
And I even want to extend that to my fellow Republicans who continue to support this president. I want to say I have deep compassion for you because you've been sold a bill of goods that simply isn't true. We're not the enemy. The non-white people in this country are not the enemy.
No. And I have a good number of wonderful Republican friends and neighbors and people that I associate with. They don't buy most of this stuff. This isn't what they wanted. What they wanted was smaller government, lowered taxes. You know, they have a different idea of what it means to be Republican and means to be conservative. This has gone to a different level. They don't like the lying. They don't like the being misled and misrepresentation. The change that I saw this week that was phenomenal to me, one of my children is a veteran, an Army veteran, and he is speaking up about the hatred and the divisiveness and the need to just stop that. And being able to talk to one another about what's going on and to reclaim the country that we know and love, all of us, Republicans and Democrats, not people who've gone off some weird zone with Trump and what's going on with him.
It's getting weird for sure. So that was very well said. We appreciate it as always. And again, for more information about any of these topics, visit nursetalksite.com or pda.org or nationalnursesunited.org. Donna, thanks for being here with us. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
That's it for today. Thanks for listening. And thank you to our executive producer, Patty Lockard, sound design and engineering, June Miller and JMC Sound, and Taylor Lockard Research.
And National Nurses United and all the nurses on duty today, and of course, our listeners and our guests.
Take care and visit us at nursetalksite.com or like our Facebook page at Nurse Talk. Coming up on Nurse Talk, Erin Murphy, a career nurse and longtime Minnesota legislator, runs for governor of Minnesota.
Going back to basics, the nurses are on duty today and will be answering your medical questions.
And Michael Moore's movie Sicko, 10 years later.
All this and more today on Nurse Talk.
Welcome to Nurse Talk. I'm Casey Hobbs, along with my co-host Shane Mason, and we are two of the thousands of nurses on duty this very day.
Thanks, Casey, and let's take a moment to thank all of our listeners on Progressive Voices TuneIn, the Tom Hartman Program, and all of our broadcast platforms.
Thank you so much. We have a great show today, Shane. In a few minutes, we'll have the pleasure to be talking with RN longtime state legislator and candidate for governor of the great state of Minnesota, Erin Murphy. Erin is one of dozens of women running for office in the 2018 midterms, and we so look forward to having her with us. I'm so happy so many are running.
And Casey, we're going to take a little walk down memory lane. We'll talk with Healthcare in America's Donna Smith about the 10-year anniversary of Michael Moore's movie Sicko. Donna, of course, was one of eight individuals who appeared in that movie.
And just to see if we still deserve our nurse's licenses, Shane, we're going to take a few of our listeners' medical questions and see if we still have that golden touch. I don't know that you had the golden touch.
I got it. I left it at home, but I got it.
Okay, I can't find mine either.
Are you going to make me push the button again?
Well, Shane, what do you think? How do you feel today? Could you use a little bit of humor? Just get that blood pumping?
Let's do it. All right, if you're over 70, it's your lucky day. Here's a clip from the Golden Sisters.
We've got to get a younger producer.
Another tweet, Joe.
Another tweet.
Oh, look, there's another one, Terry. Quit eating.
Do you think people should break up via text message?
Oh, that's chicken.
Oh, I do. I think. Yeah. Well, it is. It's very hard to break up, so it's really easy to say.
Well, that's horrible.
I don't want to see you anymore.
Yeah, that's not a man, and that's not a lady.
You know what? Via text message. Right. That used to be a dear John.
Okay, so you do it face to face, and they cry and weep and please don't leave me.
That's reality.
When you wanted to break up with somebody, what did you say?
I just told him, Tony Ciccarelli.
Oh, you know Jack?
I told him I don't want to see him anymore.
On a date?
On a date. I didn't like him.
So you told him in person.
Yes.
This is our last day.
Yeah, oh yeah.
That's because there was no texting, because you're chicken.
No, I would never. No,
you're chicken to hurt people's feelings, Mary. Yes, you are.
Not if I don't like
I would definitely say, in fact, I one time I called.
You know what, Terry, you would text.
One time I called.
You would text.
There wasn't text, right? So one time I called the secretary and says, tell him I don't want to see him.
It's so funny about that.
I don't know.
Oh, that's funny.
I come from a hardworking family that's probably a lot like yours. My dad, Bernie, built cars for General Motors for 40 years. My mom, Kaz, she worked in a canning factory and she cleaned houses. With my dad's steady union job and my mom's determination, we had a stable foundation to build our future. But no matter who you are or what you do, life is going to present challenges that you need to overcome. For me, that challenge came in 2004 when my mom was diagnosed with lung cancer. It was hard. The fear of losing her, the financial burdens, and dealing with the insurance companies. There were a lot of forms. The companies coming back, denying benefits, telling us the medicine my mom needed wouldn't be covered. I was angry. I'm a nurse. Our job is to care for people and their families during such trying times. Our healthcare system should be there to help, not create obstacles.
National Nurses United, the nation's largest union of registered nurses, last week announced its endorsement of Minnesota State Representative Erin Murphy for governor of Minnesota. We are endorsing Erin because she's a proven champion fighting for all Minnesotans. said Jean Ross, RN, co-president of National Nurses United.
As a registered nurse herself, Erin stands for nurses, values of caring, compassion, and community, values that most Minnesotans share. National Nurses United is proud to support her. This is one of dozens of high-profile endorsements Murphy has received, including Emily's List.
We're proud to welcome candidate for governor in the great state of Minnesota, Erin Murphy. Erin, it's a pleasure to have you with us today on Nurse Talk.
Yeah, I'm so happy to join you. Thank you for having me.
Erin, you grew up in a small town in Wisconsin, but later you moved to Minnesota. Talk about how your childhood shaped your desire to become a nurse and then to become a political leader.
I was born in a little town, Columbus, Wisconsin, but mostly grew up in Janesville, Wisconsin. And my dad built cars for a living there. My mom cleaned houses for a living there. And I grew up in a family who loved to talk about politics. When I would go to my grandma's house, we would hang out together. And all my cousins, I come from a big Irish family, all my cousins would go outside and play. But I always stayed inside with the grown-ups because they played cards. My job was to mix the drinks. That was my job when I was a kid. And then they would talk about politics. And I thought it was interesting, and they taught me that it was important. And so I grew up with that belief, chose nursing when I was in college. And I chose nursing because I care a lot about people, and I like science. So it was a natural fit for me, but it didn't take me very long in the early practice of nursing for me. And I worked first in a rural hospital in Wisconsin in Marshfield. It didn't take long to understand that if I really wanted to impact the health of the people I was taking care of, I needed to look outside the walls of that hospital to understand the conditions that were driving people into the hospital. And that's where I found my interest in the marriage between nursing and healthcare and health policy and politics.
No, that's great. It makes perfect sense. In the state legislature, you became House Majority Leader and fought for Minnesota Care. Can you tell us a little bit about that program?
When I first went to work for the Minnesota Nurses Association, now 1991, I was an organizer for them. And in those first 2 years when I organized for M&A, we passed Minnesota Care here in the state. And we decided together as Minnesotans that if you work full-time for a living, but you don't get your health care through your employer, that we should create the means for coverage for you. And we did that and led the nation when we passed it and put it into law in 1992. And I remember thinking, like, Minnesota has really got something special here because we took a big idea and we made it the law of our state. And I had missed the early years of organizing to build support for that idea. And there were many years of organizing, but it showed me, right, our capacity to take on a tough issue and actually make the kind of change I believe in. And I've been participating ever since. So when I was elected in 2007, I started working right away on health care and health policy. It's one of the reasons I decided to run after I took care of my mom at the end of her life. And I have had the opportunity to work on a number of health initiatives, Freedom to Breathe, health care homes, the expansion of Minnesota Care, the expansion of medical assistance when the Affordable Care Act passed. So I've been fortunate to be working and living in a time in Minnesota where we have been doing a lot of work on health coverage. But unfortunately, even with good coverage, we know that there are people that can't bear the cost of health care. And that issue is becoming really acute for a lot of people in the state of Minnesota.
So let's talk about why you're running for governor. You've done a little of that groundwork. Talk again about what brings you to it and who you're running against.
So I believe in a kind of politics that is about us, about our future. And when we put ourselves to that and talk about the things that bold solutions to the problems that we actually face here in the state of Minnesota, we can not only win, but govern and make progress for the people. That's what I want to do. And in the last number of years, I've watched Minnesota move in the direction more like a Washington, D.C. style of politics where the issues of the day are really about just beating the other side, scoring points, and not focusing on what we need to do to build our future. And that's frustrating to me, and I know it's frustrating to the people of Minnesota, and that's why I decided to run. I'm in a primary with two other well-known Democrats, a member of Congress named Tim Walz, and the current Attorney General, a woman named Lori Swanson, who literally got into the race a month ago after I earned the DFL endorsement. So our primary is August the 14th. I got into this race in November of 2016, right after the presidential election. I'm not good at hedging bets. I'm not interested in saying I'm going to do something or I might do something if I plan to do it. So I got in to be clear with the people of Minnesota and to build a campaign that I believe in, one that is built from the ground up. And we are as successful as we are now in this race because of that early work and spending my time all over the state of Minnesota. There will be a primary on the Republican side as well. Former Governor Tim Pawlenty, who was the governor here for 8 years, four of those years were my early years in the Minnesota House. He left the state of Minnesota to run for president. He did not, of course, get elected to be the president, but he left our state with a $6 billion budget deficit, and he's running again. And then there's a Hennepin County commissioner named Jeff Johnson, who's run for governor once and didn't win, and he is running one more time. So I will square off with one of the two of them once I've won the primary. And we're building a campaign, of course, now that is prepared to beat one of them. So in November, knock on wood, I will be elected governor for the state of Minnesota.
So you also just rolled out what you're calling a pathway to single-payer plan this week. And in a press release, you say every Minnesotan deserves health care they can count on and the freedom that comes from knowing you always have access to the health care you need. So can you give us some highlights of that plan?
Sure. I'm really excited about this, and we've spent the week all over the state of Minnesota talking about it. And as I had mentioned earlier, I've been working in healthcare in Minnesota for a long time, and never have I seen the kind of appetite for broad, bold systemic change as I am today in the state of Minnesota. And it's because people are really struggling with the cost of care and with the networks that have shrunk under the control of the health plans. So my pathway includes opening up Minnesota Care program that we put into law 26 years ago for anybody, and to use a provision that I put into law back in 2010 that will allow us to contract directly with the providers and to move the health plans, the health insurance companies, out of the middle of that equation, right? They're using their powerful tools and their networks to deny people care. And I think it's time for us to depart from that and to contract directly with the providers. I want to use the powerful purchasing power of the state of Minnesota to get a better deal on pharmaceuticals for the people of Minnesota in that program in Minnesota Care. And if we're not successful there in negotiating a better deal, then I want to follow the path of Vermont and figure out how we can import our drugs from Canada. There's a man here in the state of Minnesota, a family that I know. They had a son named Alec Smith. Alec was 26 years old. He worked for a living. He aged out of his parents' insurance because he turned 26. He was an insulin-dependent diabetic and couldn't afford his insulin, and so was rationing it, and he lost his life. And he was only 26 years old, and for me, it is a canary in the coal mine moment. The 26-year-old should not lose his life because his drugs are too expensive, especially insulin that has been available for decades.
That's just such a horrendous story.
It is, and it was a cheap drug, but it isn't right now because the drug companies know that they can make a lot of money on it, and there's nothing stopping them, and so they are. And that's what's wrong with our system right now.
So, Erin, let's mention you can visit your website at murphy4mn.com.
There are people all over the state, I think, that are very, very interested in Medicare for All, Minnesota Care for All, a single-payer system, because they know the system is broken and it's not serving the health needs of the people of Minnesota. And they want to see a systemic change. And I keep telling people I have the head and the heart and the experience to get this done with the people of Minnesota. And for me, it isn't a political argument. It is one rooted in my profession and my values. And I think when we build our efforts on our values, on our shared values, that's how we make sustainable change. And that's what we'll do on this hard question.
Excellent. And just quickly, are there any other issues or topics you'd like to discuss with our listeners?
So, you know, this campaign is one about ambition for our future. And we are talking about the tough issues that we face, whether it is the fact that we have people that are aging all over the state of Minnesota and we're not quite ready or prepared for their care. They're going to leave the workforce, and we already have workforce shortages in the state in healthcare and teaching and manufacturing. And we're going to have to figure out how more people come to the state of Minnesota, which touches on that tough issue of immigration. And if the Congress is not going to get their act together, then we're going to have to figure out how we make sure that Minnesota is a place where anyone who wants to can come and work and live and build their businesses and support their families so that we have an economy that continues to grow in the state of Minnesota. We also are a state that prides itself at being at the top of many lists, but we are a state right now that is the second most unequal state when it comes to racial disparities. And that, for me, is unacceptable and something we're going to fix when I'm the governor of the state of Minnesota. A lot of the tools that I was raised with, collective bargaining, organizing, voting, tools of our democracy, they are under assault all over the country. and we got to hang on to them, and I will, and we're going to use them together to build a future for the people of Minnesota when I'm elected, and I am thrilled to be with you and your listeners today.
Excellent. So we're talking with RN and gubernatorial candidate for the state of Minnesota, Erin Murphy. For more information about Erin's campaigns and the issues she's fighting for, visit murphyformn.com.
And now people can also donate to your campaign on your site as well as at emilyslist.org. Is that correct?
That's correct. And I would welcome that. If you hear in me a person that you can support, I hope that you will make a gift to our campaign and help us continue to grow and win this race. And, you know, every campaign is expensive. We are a very frugal campaign, but your gifts will certainly help us. So please give.
Excellent.
All right. Thank you so much for being with us today. And thank you for all of the work and leadership you provided during your career as a nurse, nurse leader, and people's representative.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. You're listening to Nurse Talk Radio. We'll be right back with more.
You're listening to Nurse Talk, where laughter's the best medicine.
I believe that one person can make a difference, and I try to live my life that way. That's why I'm involved in the California One Care campaign. We're not going to fix our health care system until you, and I mean you, get up and help us. Join the campaign for single-payer, universal health care. Make a donation, volunteer your time, recruit your friends and family. You can make a difference, and now is your chance. Do it.
California One Care. Full care for all for less.
Hey, Casey, say that part where they won't sue us.
We are nurses. We cannot diagnose, prescribe, or treat, but we can give good advice.
We're sticking up for affordable health care for everyone. Everyone deserves great plans that has that coverage when they need it most in their lives.
Hello, I'm Casey Hobbs.
And I'm Shane Mason, and we're the hosts of Nurse Talk Radio.
Here's what we're talking about this week.
Talk about the importance of Senator Bernie Sanders' bill that both strengthens unions and wipes out right-to-work laws. What would the bill do, and why is it necessary?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's a great bill. I mean, thank goodness that Bernie is fighting back on this issue, and there's quite a few co-sponsors at this point. So Bernie's bill really would take the energy that we see in the country right at the moment from teachers. Teachers across the country are doing just a fabulous job and standing up and forcing their districts and their states to pay attention to what's going on. And it's showing the strength and the solidarity that comes from when you stand together in union with other people. So the bill actually takes a lot of the issues that we find in first setting of contracts for workers, you know, when people are trying to first organize into a union. Sometimes, I know it'll be shocking to imagine, but employers sometimes dig their heels in and slow everything down so that they don't have to really implement anything that a contract might make them do. So Bernie's bill actually requires that there be action in a timely way on issues that happen in contracts. They can't just sit on them and wait forever and ever and ever to have something happen. The other thing it really starts to do, we have seen so many of these misnamed right-to-work kind of provisions all across the country, which really aren't a right-to-work, folks. Everybody knows that, I think, or most people do, that it really is just a euphemism for saying that you don't want people to be in a union.
Yeah.
And it really starts to protect some of those things that we're seeing take a hit, like we saw in Wisconsin with Scott Walker, where he tried so desperately to injure the public employee unions and take the teeth out of them by allowing people to opt out of being union members. Well, we need to stop doing that. We need to stop weakening unions, and we need to shore them up, make sure that employees can stand together in a strong union that has teeth enough to move a contract and enforce a contract when there is one. It forces arbitration if there's a dispute so that we can move things along. We're not going to get it done before this Congress is out of office, but when we boot these people out in November and put in some people who can actually act independently of the Trump situation, yes, there is a chance we could get it done.
Thanks for listening. You can find more information about these topics at nursetalksite.com or nationalnursesunited.org.
This podcast is powered by National Nurses United, the nation's largest union for registered nurses. Welcome back to Nurse Talk. I'm Casey Hobbs, along with Shane Mason, and we are two of the thousands of nurses on duty today.
And Casey, let's revisit this conversation about the 10-year anniversary of Michael Moore's movie Sicko.
I had an abdominal cancer that required surgery and a little bit of radiation, and afterwards I developed a huge abdominal hernia requiring a follow-up surgery and a mesh put in my belly. And the insurance company pre-certified, but I constantly worried about how much time from work was I missing, was I going to endanger my benefits, would I lose pay. My first thought was not, oh my God, I have cancer and I might die. My very first thought was, oh my God, I have cancer, what if I miss work? What if my insurance won't pay this? Maybe it'd be better off if it is cancer that I just die quickly and not hang around and create bigger bills and trauma for the family.
And here with us is Healthcare in America senior correspondent Donna Smith. Donna, welcome. Always a pleasure.
Greetings, Nurse Talk friends.
So Donna, that interview took place 9 years ago. So were you optimistic at the time maybe that our country's healthcare system would be transformed or at least improved by now?
Absolutely, of course. You know, we were sitting on the edge of Barack Obama taking office, and I think many of us, rightly or wrongly, were extremely hopeful that this was going to bring the kind of change and energy we needed to getting the healthcare system straightened out a little bit. I don't think any of us were quite ready to say that we'd achieve Medicare for All right away, but we thought we would do much better and we would get to a place where more people were able to access healthcare.
That's for sure. So what gains do you think we've made towards single payer? Any?
Absolutely. I do think we've made some gains. I think it's hard to see it sometimes, and certainly right now when we have some attacks taking place yet again on the Affordable Care Act. While the Affordable Care Act certainly is not single payer, and it's not Medicare for All by any stretch, it does get a lot more people to the point of having coverage and having access to care that they need. So while some of us may decry the fact that it's not nearly as affordable as it needs to be, and it doesn't get us to the point where we can get everybody adequately covered and do so without financial barrier to care, it did result in a huge amount of coverage for people, especially through the expansion of the Medicaid program, which gave the biggest gains to people who had coverage and, interestingly, is a public program. It's not private insurance, not a private market insurance plan. It is public insurance, and it is insurance that is provided essentially with a single-payer model.
And so what do you think with this possible passing of the tax bill where it's taking a big hit at the Affordable Care Act? What do you think our chances are? How are we going to fight this?
Well, here's something that I think people often don't know yet, is that even the repeal of the individual mandate, that part of the Obamacare Affordable Care Act that required that people either buy private insurance or that they pay a penalty during filing of their taxes, even if that goes away, that provision is not due to take place until 2019. So we have time yet to push on this and to make sure that it doesn't actually become the way that we handle health care. We don't want to go back to the days when people had trouble getting coverage. That's just not good. The other thing that we're going to have to be very alert about fighting is, in order to pay for all these wonderful tax cuts to the wealthy, we want to make sure that they don't cut Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security. So we've got work to do as citizens to make sure that we let these little darlings in the Congress know, don't do that. There are too many people that rely on Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security for any kind of stability in their financial lives or in their health care access. So we're going to have to let senators, representatives know constantly, all right, we see that you're repealing this particular provision of the Affordable Care Act now. How are you going to move forward on Medicare for All so that we're actually fixing the system?
So are there any positives to look forward to in 2018 that we know or with some certainty are going to be improvements?
Oh, I think so. I'm more hopeful now than I was through the period of the summer when we were looking at that skinny repeal bill and we were having so much struggle around the Republicans just really wanting to get rid of as much of the Affordable Care Act as they could. But we're also seeing tremendous progress. Look at the work that Bernie Sanders has done in the Senate with S-1804, which is a Medicare for All measure. 16 Senate co-sponsors. That is an enormous, enormously positive thing. So we can look forward to getting more senators educated about what that means for this country and why it would be such a great economic benefit. We also have in California SB 562, which people have been working on and rallying around and really doing a lot of wonderful organizing work around. So many more Californians and many more Americans know what it would mean to have a Medicare for All and how much that would really benefit all of us. So we have a lot of positives to work on this coming year. We're just going to have to stay very vigilant, make sure that we keep that positive energy going. We can't just fight against what we think is bad. We have to fight for what we believe would be good to replace it. And that certainly is Bernie's bill in the Senate, 1804, and in California, SB 562 would be fabulous to get that done. And I'm looking forward to being very active in 2018.
Well, we're looking forward to it as well, Donna, so I'm glad to hear you're doing well. We want to thank you for the great work you're doing today, and thanks for being with us.
Absolutely. Thank you all.
We've been talking with Donna Smith, our Healthcare in America senior correspondent. Donna is also the executive director of Progressive Democrats of America. For more information on these topics, visit nursetalksite.com, pda.org, or nnu.org. Shane.
Yes. Yes, Casey.
Remember when we used to take medical questions from our listeners?
Of course I do. It was one of the biggest joys of my life and career. Do we get to do it again?
That's I'm why you're suffering from depression, dude. If this is the biggest thing in your life.
I thought the lawyers told us to stop.
He did. I do think we need to remind our listeners that we are actual nurses and we do care about each and every listener we have, and we want to help them, guide them through good choices about their medical concerns. Are you up for that?
Yes, but Casey, remember, we are nurses, and as such, we cannot diagnose or treat, but we can give advice and recommend that you always follow up what you hear on our show with sound clinical advice from a doctor or nurse practitioner or such.
Shane, let's take the first question.
All right, so what is the difference between heat exhaustion and a heat stroke, and can either of them kill you? This is from Linda M. in Orlando, Florida, and it's hot there.
It's very hot there. And I can see why she's asking the question. Yes, heat stroke is very serious, and heat stroke untreated could kill you. Heat exhaustion is more common. And the problem with heat exhaustion is that usually you're suffering from dehydration. So you want to get out of the sun, go to a shady spot, drink plenty of water, look for signs of weakness, headache, loss of consciousness. You could also be having some salt depletion. So you might want to get some Gatorade or something with electrolytes in it. Signs of salt depletion include nausea, vomiting, muscle cramps, and dizziness.
I got heat exhaustion once.
Did you?
Yep, in Garberville, California.
Really? In Garberville?
I was playing in a reggae festival, and I got, after the show, I was wandering around, didn't know where I was.
Wow. You didn't even know it. So, you're pretty fair skinned, so I could see.
I can get heat exhaustion just by looking at a picture of the sun with this skin, to tell the truth.
Yeah, because you're such a...
Question number two.
Hello, Nurse Talk. My name is Jamie P., and I live in Phoenix, Arizona. I was just told by a doctor that I have Valley Fever. Are you familiar with Valley Fever and what causes it? I told him I had been drinking a lot of beer lately, and he said that makes perfect sense because the fever has something to do with the yeast or mold, and the beer was fueling the fever. Anyway, he said my desire for beer would probably go away after the treatment kicks in. He prescribed 6 months worth of antibiotics. What do you think?
This sounds like a bunch of craziness to me.
It is a bunch of craziness.
To be honest, but I don't think I'm supposed to say that. So,
well, Valley Fever is not that serious, and most people who get Valley Fever don't even know that they have it, and they get the disease takes its course, and it's out of their system before they even know it.
So I could have it right now, is what you're saying? Great. One more thing to worry about. Thanks.
The definitive diagnosis depends on finding evidence of the coccidioorganisms in tissue, blood, or other body secretions, but mostly people get over this without any treatment. Now, somebody prescribing you 6 months of antibiotic for valley fever and
that's
also suggesting that you have, that beer increases your chances or the virulence of the disease seems off base to me. And 6 months of antibiotics is not something I would recommend for anybody. It's wiping out the natural flora and fauna, and you're going to have far more troubles taking 6 months of antibiotics than you were just going through the course of valley fever.
We're not telling you not to take your medicine. Let's be clear.
That's true, but what I would say is you need to seek a second opinion.
Yeah, and probiotics, you got to take your probiotics if you're going to take all the antibiotics, for sure.
And I would ask this person to go have a second medical opinion. Go see another doctor. 6 months of antibiotics is way too heavy-handed for a valley fever. Seek medical attention elsewhere is what I would say to that question, Shane.
That's right. And that's it for today, folks. Thanks for listening. And thank you to our executive producer, Patty Lockard, sound design and engineering, June Miller and JMC Sound, Taylor Lockard Research,
and National Nurses United, and all the nurses on duty today, and of course, our listeners and guests.
Take care and visit us at nursetalksite.com or like our Facebook page at Nurse Talk.